Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Today is Tuesday, April 21st, 2020. We are here for our 15th call together. Wow, we've made it to April together, rounding out into our last few weeks, 6, 7 weeks maybe, not sure. Big welcome. It's good to be here with you. Star 2 to connect. I already see a couple of hands raised, which is great. let's start with our 1 minute of being in quiet space together. I'm stepping outside so that you can listen to the sounds of spring as we drop into our bodies, our hearts, our souls, the neglected places in our culture. Allowing for, I hope you can hear the water and the birds, allowing for these magnificent sounds, the songs of nature to fill your well. Even if it's only for 1 minute, it's extraordinary how we can be restored and replenished in a very short amount of time when we allow ourselves. And by filling the well, I don't mean being filled with joy, although that may be your experience. It really means becoming present to whatever is needing attention inside of you. So we'll be in this space for 1 minute, and then I'll turn to you. Okay, I want to say one more thing, which is an invitation to imagine that we are all connected in this moment, everyone who was on this call, from Paris, from Ireland, from all over the United States, from all over the world, really. Imagining that there are ribbons of light connecting us. So that we remember that whatever we are struggling with or rejoicing, whatever we are experiencing together as one human family. And I think if there's been anything we can glean from this time that we're in, that we really are one human family. Okay. Hello, who is this?
It's Ruth.
It's you. Oh, hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I just really want to have a conversation today and feel very grateful to have the opportunity.
Yes, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. And I find sometimes with these calls I get so kind of nervous that I forget and aren't very articulate and I can't really express myself. So I wrote a couple of things down to help me. Is it okay if I kind of just read I've got a couple of notes to help me express?
Yes, perfect. Thank you. And if there's any way to improve your connection, it would be helpful on my end.
Okay.
That's better if you could maybe talk.
Is that better?
I think so.
Okay. Okay. Just let me know, and then I don't mind being interrupted to help, okay?
Yeah, sounds good now. Thank you.
Okay. So this really is about... okay, 1 second. This is about pain that I feel and how I react to kind of different levels of pain. And it's really, it was well expressed in an email that was sent this week about how there isn't really an amount of pain to be qualified or not.
Yes.
So it's just a little bit of reflections on this, of sort of what's allowed and what's not. So I have a hard time with a conflicting emotion to managing pain that you so beautifully wrote about this week. And cognitively, I really understand that it's my relationship towards... So cognitively, I understand that it's important for me to break through this whilst also noticing that I've got a very difficult relationship with it.
Yes.
And I'm somehow not allowing this to sort of be integrated into my body, and so my head constantly gets in the way. And I can't really get my whole head around pain not being quantifiable. But it really feeds a kind of the critic in me, like I'm acting like some sort of head of judgment who is sort of allowing, sort of saying what pain is allowed and what pain's not. And it's like a moving target. And I think it's kind of, you know, that kind of casual statement of it's a first world problem, first world, hashtag first world,
yes,
really feeds this, because I'm like, yeah, it does feel like a first world problem, and I definitely judge it. And I know I judge my husband the most from it as well, but I also know that I'm judging myself when I do have a problem like that, that's sort of allowing this ugly part of me to feel like this. And I really thought about it and thought that growing up, my pain was diminished quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it was with, so I did often have kind of references of starving children in Africa that was casually swept across the dinner table, or often my mom or my sister trying to rescue sort of bad, difficult feelings for me. And so then I never really had to feel them. But then having gone to Zambia and seen quite a lot of very difficult issues, and witnessing a lot of pain and feeling like I didn't have a lot of agency to change it, I kind of knew what it means when people say that. I know what it means, and they're like, oh, it's a frame of reference, I guess, that allows a kind of context to make you feel better. But I really am wanting to offer something different to the way that I bring up my daughter and my inner child, to have a safer landing experience, not be dismissive of pain that can grow, and sort of be the monitorer of what's allowed and what's not. I know I've got an internal league table of what I think is allowed and not, and I feel like I need some compassion to stop me with all this.
Yes. Well, beautifully expressed. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.
a very common struggle for people, and perhaps highlighted now in the times that we're in and what we're going through, but I think it's always a struggle. Largely because, as you so beautifully articulated, that most people grew up with their pain being invalidated for one reason or another, diminished, judged, shamed, or compared, right? You have nothing to complain about, think about the starving children in Africa. So from your wise, compassionate self on the cognitive level, how would you respond?
I respond cognitively by knowing that people can only operate with the experience that they've operated and that the experiences that they've got, and that that's their context, and that's not a place of judgment. That's just how people are.
Yeah.
And that pain is how people react and perceive it, as opposed to this internal league table that I've made up.
Yeah. Good. I love the internal league table. And remembering that those characters at the table, those figures, are protectors. They are ultimately there to try to protect you from your pain. So underneath the, Brené Brown talks about this so well, and I can't remember the exact term she used, but it's something like comparative suffering is not helpful. So
yeah.
Everyone's suffering is valid. And I just have to share, the synchronicity of your question is extraordinary to me, because literally 5 minutes before this phone call, I went into the house to get some water, and my husband was sharing an interaction he had with his brother over text. And, well, the whole family, he has a million siblings, they're all over on a group text chain. And the brother was saying that it's really hard because his daughter, who's a ballerina and is 16 now, is going to miss out on many opportunities because they will be close to her by the time she's 17. And if she doesn't get to go this year, which she was supposed to go to New York, and she was supposed to go to South America, and of course everything is shut down, that she may be losing her opportunity. And my husband responded, trying to offer some empathy, saying, we understand, we're going through something similar with our son who can't fly right now. And when you stop flying, not only is flying his medicine and his deepest joy for his soul, but
yeah.
You lose your skill. It's not like riding a bike. So, and he's missing out on opportunities as well. And he's very sad and very disappointed. And then my husband's brother wrote back and said, well, it's not like our kids are, you know, in the Holocaust or anything. And then somebody
yeah.
else from the chimed in and said, well, right, and kids are dying in Syria. And it was,
yeah.
you know, this way of invalidating the experience of these two teenagers that are struggling with their
yeah.
experience, their deepest joy that's being taken away, and their opportunities that are being taken away. And so when we compare pain, the only thing it does is reduce empathy. And for ourselves, and then for the suffering in the world. There's nothing positive that comes from the comparative suffering. So,
yeah.
you know, when you get into relationship with those characters at your table and you start to dialogue with them, you will see that ultimately all of those responses are ways to avoid pain, and they work, because when
yeah.
you listen, right, your own pain is then hijacked, or your husband's pain, or your daughter's pain, or whatever it is. And it speaks to how difficult it is for us to sit with another's pain and our own.
Yeah.
You know, and if you want to really take it out into the realm of the world and the interconnectedness, the more we meet our own pain, the more compassion we have, the more we open to being of service in some way, whether it's the way you raise your daughter or it's work that you end up doing in Africa, and one is not more or less valid than the other.
Yeah.
So what you're also asking, what I'm hearing, Ruth, is that I think you know all this, and how do you then let it integrate on the level of your body and of yourself? Because the judgers come up so quickly, lightning fast, and then they take over, they hijack the whole experience. And so it's really a practice to slow down those moments when you notice that the judger has taken over, and get into dialogue with the judger instead of trying to just bypass it or sweep it aside or say, or even addressing it cognitively by saying, well, but my pain's valid too, right? Then you're just sort of in argument with these much stronger parts of you that have had a lot more airtime in your life.
Yeah.
As opposed to really engaging and time traveling back to that first dinner table when starving children in Africa were passed alongside the peas and the carrots as a way to invalidate and protect you from your pain. And so imagining even the two tables merging in some way, the inner table of psyche and the first dinner table of family. It's in the imaginal realm that the words that we know, the beliefs that we know to be true, eventually trickle down into a somatic knowing. Right? It's the imaginal that is the bridge between the two, a bridge anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're right. I think what you said about bringing it out into the world in some sort of service, which is, again, I guess what you wrote about with the hope, you know, the book of joy. I think what comes to me is, you know, when I'm having just conversations, casual conversations with my husband or family, and I just feel like a sense of meaninglessness. And sort of sitting with that is very uncomfortable. But that's because I haven't found my way of how to serve, I guess.
Can you give me an example of a conversation that feels meaningless?
Yeah. It's not necessarily to do with pain, but I can sometimes feel like things really, really slowing down where I'm like, I am, the critic judge is coming out here, is like, if there's anything to do with like meal planning.
Mm-hmm.
So any conversations about, I mean, they're just like practical, good conversations, you know, it just happened just now before we, you know, did our chop, and I was just a little bit like, I just don't care. I'm just so happy that I've got food. It doesn't matter what we eat. Why are we even doing this? This is such a first world issue. Blah, this narrative kind of pipes in.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's trying to slow down and go, why is this bringing such a visceral reaction in me? And I think,
yes,
it's because sense of meaninglessness in it. And I'm like, and I've chosen this, and I don't feel fulfilled because we're not talking about anything that's helpful. We're just, you know.
So, great example. I'm curious what else might be going on in that moment. If you were to slow it down even more, the judger comes in. Your husband's talking about meal planning. Completely valid conversation to be having.
Yeah.
Part of our world, part of our lives, at least our lives. And then the critic comes up and says, why are we having this conversation? What else might be going on? Let's even put the comparative suffering aside, because that's a defense. What else might you be feeling in that moment when your husband brings up that conversation?
I think I'm unsure in this moment, I think fear comes up a bit. I think I noticed fear of something.
It sounds to me like resistance. And resistance is coming up in the form of, this is meaningless. Why are we having this stupid conversation?
Yeah.
But so the question is resistance to what? Resistance to being an adult and planning, or resistance to taking responsibility?
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah, I'm just kind of, I'm trying to feel that, what I feel in those moments before, because it's so quick, and it immediately I thought I was doing well by recognizing it was the meaninglessness, but it's not. It's my reaction towards it is the issue.
Yeah, well, the meaninglessness, I don't think, is the core feeling. That's the judgment that comes from your head saying, this is meaningless. This is a ridiculous situation. That's still coming from your head. So there's a feeling first. Something subtle that comes, that is triggered around certain types of conversations. You probably won't know in this moment.
Yeah.
To put on your micro lens of curiosity next time it comes up, and even reviewing, because it just happened. It's recent. And so I would encourage you, when we're done, to write and to see if you can get to it and land on it. You'll know. You'll know in your body when you land on it and you have an opening, you have an aha, you have a yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll do that.
Good. Anything else?
I think it was just interesting that I've got such a lot of empathy for, I mean, it'd be really considered that, you know, I was highly empathic and, you know, in general, and I feel a lot of feelings of others. And then sometimes I can be so unempathic for things that I don't consider important. And that I really don't like about myself. I'm like, I don't understand why that defense comes up. And I'm curious as to why this really gruff figure comes to the front of this dismissiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Good. And it's that curiosity that's going to open up the aperture, right? So that you can explore. Who is this figure that comes up? You know, it's a lot easier in some ways to feel empathy for the pain of the world and for people that we don't know than for our own selves and for the people closest to us. And so I say that, Ruth, because I hear that judgment coming up, the self-judgment of, I hate this part of me. And that's a very human part. It is the most difficult, like the exchange with my husband and his siblings, of, you know, how easy it is to swipe away, to sideline our own pain and the pain of our kids, pain of our loved ones, and go right to, but kids in Syria are dying. Well, both are true, and there's room for multiple layers of suffering. And yet how much easier it is in some ways to diminish our own pain and focus on the world.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Okay. Good. Moving right along. Hello, Tracy.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. So I guess the last caller, just talking about first world problems, I've got another first world problem. And it's been on my mind for a little while now. I just feel so like such a horrible person for actually like thinking these things, but they've been like driving me down this rabbit hole, so I've gotta get out of it.
I wanna stop for a moment, Tracy. I think we need to collectively re-examine this term, first world problems. It's very shaming to any of our suffering. And I guarantee you, Ruth, who just spoke, listening right now, is wanting to just send a big hug to you, whatever it is that you're thinking, feeling, and everyone on this call. Our pain is our pain. That's it. It's not first world pain. It's just pain of being human. So with that said, I hear so much shame coming up for you for even having the thoughts, whatever they are. But I want to give you some shame reducer. Whatever they are, they're causing you suffering. And all suffering is suffering. That's it. Okay. Continue, please.
I just feel super shallow with like the thoughts, but they kind of, I just got married last year, and I'm 39, my husband's 41, and when I was reading a lot of your stuff about relationship anxiety, I was always like, oh, I'm so glad that hasn't spiked for me. It's a bunch of other stuff, but not relationship anxiety. But now that's spiking all of a sudden. And it started, I think it's part relationship anxiety, part money anxiety. And it started because my husband's career is just a little bit like all over the place right now. And it almost feels like he's at the start of his career, and he just started his own practice. He's an orthopedic surgeon, and it's hard and it's not going well, and he doesn't have like a network of colleagues in LA that he can reach out to or network with or get like referral sources. And it's just leading to a lot of, thoughts about this future and our life. And, you know, he'll say things about how difficult it is in LA to compete in the market. And that if we move to Bakersfield or something, that he could get, you know, a great job and it wouldn't be an issue. He doesn't want to move to Bakersfield, but it's this thought in my head that, oh, we're going to end up in Bakersfield and I'm going to have to give up everything that I've built in my life here in LA. And I worked hard in my career and I like did all the networking and I, you know, reached out and did all this hard work to establish myself and, you know, be in a place that I'm stable. And now that's going to just, you know, I'm just going to have to give that up because this other person didn't do all the stuff that I had to do for years and years and years. And then it kind of trickles into this weird thought, and like maybe I'm watching too much Downton Abbey, but it's like, did I marry down? And like, would my life have been so much different if I married someone else, like that that would almost like, you know, could it could change your life, and did I not put enough, you know, thought into that? And then it trickles further into, you know, things like trying to buy a house, and if I had married someone who was in a similar position to I am, and we were very much like, you know, marriage is 50-50, and, you know, that whole line of thinking. And so I feel like a little bit like in this department, like I'm carrying the torch here, and I'm helping him with his business and making phone calls and, you know, doing all these things. And even like my father is, you know, trying to help and things like that. And like on his side of the family, they're just not as helpful, and they're a bit more frugal, and it's not like they're helping me try to land new clients. Like, so he gets like all these benefits, and I'm still the one doing everything by myself, or sort of like leading the charge. And so if I was with someone who was in the same position I would, then we wouldn't have like a problem buying a house and buying a house in a certain neighborhood, or, and then, you know, not having this fear of moving to Fresno, or I don't know. It's just one thing after another. And also like, you know, his, like I'd have a, you know, in-laws that are kind of more maybe like supportive, or could like benefit my life in new ways, like open me up to different things. But instead, like I'm the one sort of leading the charge, and just, I don't know. It's so horrible because he's so wonderful and amazing, and having these thoughts about like that I married down just totally grossed me out. I can't believe that I'd think that. But it's just been leading me down to all this anxiety about the future, and like almost like choosing a life, like that I made this big choice and this life that I maybe wanted, that it's not an option anymore. Like it's just going to be this now, like this mediocre life or something that I have to just kind of settle for and wrap my brain around, because that's the path, like, and everything else is, it's just too hard or something.
Good. Thank you, Tracy. So, number one, classic textbook relationship anxiety. I'm sorry, but you have joined the club. And anyone listening who has struggled with relationship anxiety, I'm sure, is nodding their head. And I know at least a couple of people on this call have had the exact same thought about I've married down. It's a protective thought. That's all it is. It's not reflective of who you are as a human being. It's not reflective of your integrity or your value system. It's a protective thought, and it's protecting you from the reality. There's been a big shattering of fantasy around what you thought life and marriage and couplehood and everything would look like. And, you know, you said it sort of jokingly, but you may want to stop watching shows that reinforce the mindset that is not helpful, for real, because all that does is fan that fire of that there's even such thing as a way to marry up or marry down, that's how we classify humans, because in your deepest self, that is not how you would classify your husband. It's a culturally conditioned mindset. And it's all a protection against the shattering of the fantasy and the grieving process that you're in. You just got married. And you waited to get married. And we all have ideas and fantasies and expectations of how we think marriage is going to go and what it's going to make us feel. And I don't know, I would guess 90% of the people that I talk to have disappointment about their in-laws, for example, and mm-hmm. grieve the loss of the fantasy in-laws that we all kind of wish we had, but we don't. And if you are lucky enough to have that, that's great, but there will be many other aspects of marriage that fall short of the fantasy. And so, in case, this is the root of relationship anxiety. This is the root message. Encased inside all of the thoughts are feelings that are difficult to feel, often connected to grieving a loss that you don't even know that you're grieving, and a fantasy that you've had that you may not even have known that you've had.
It's funny because I always thought that I had such a practical vision of marriage, you know, like I never had a fantasy of happily ever after and my husband saving me, and by me having this like picture of a 50-50 marriage, I thought I was being so practical, you know, with my I guess image of what it would be. And so it seems like it's almost a shattering of my own, like, oh, look, I'm so practical here and think like I'm not going to be disappointed because I've already thought about the realness of marriage or whatnot. I guess
maybe I just didn't. Yes, we don't know our fantasies until in the situation that we have fantasized about. Until then, they're just ideas often latent in the subconscious layer. So it's when we get married that our fantasies about marriage emerge. It's when we become a parent that our fantasies about motherhood emerge. Prior to that, they're often unconscious. So it's now is the time, Tracy, to write down, to journal through what may I have been thinking and fantasizing that I'm only now seeing? What is being, and you'll know what that is by where your disappointment is. Right, like the in-laws. Like this idea of 50-50. Marriage is not 50-50. Maybe over the course of many decades, it might even out, kind of. But on a day-to-day or month-to-month reading, it's never 50-50. And we get out of trouble in marriage when we expect it to be 50-50. And we start to keep score. Because we also can't measure so much of what marriage offers and the ways that we offer to our spouse. So if we're focused on finances or career gain, we're going to lose sight of, well, how does my husband show up for me? What does he bring? What does he offer?
Yeah. The other thought that sort of has been popping up too is before I got married for years and years and years, I always felt like, you know, every woman had to make a choice between like the alpha guy and the beta guy. And they were two choices that both, you know, weren't great. If you go with the alpha guy, you have someone who's like, you know, an ambitious sort of go-getter, but he's usually a jerk because he's so caught up in himself and selfish and not thoughtful. The beta guy is usually, you know, sensitive and sweet and thoughtful and great on all these things, and then, you know, a little bit less ambitious and not as much of a go-getter. And I always struggled between the two. And I thought when I met my husband that I sort of met this happy medium where he was a little bit of both, and it was, you know, beautiful combination. And now I feel like, oh, man, maybe I just thought it was that, but he's really the beta guy. And, like, I just need to accept that fact that I'm the alpha and I'm going to be the breadwinner and I'm going to be that person, and I just need to accept that role and kind of do it, even though I feel intimidated by it.
Yes, for now. That may be what the story is for now. You are at the starting gate of hopefully a lifelong marriage.
Yeah.
So we want to be careful that we don't write the end of the story on the first page. That's
yeah.
What, like right now. It might be very different in 5 years or 10. I mean, the fact is your husband's an orthopedic surgeon, so he obviously has a fair amount of drive and follow through, right? To get to where he is. So he's struggling with marketing and the networking aspect. Yes, that's a struggle for a lot of people. But you know, to also have some faith that he will find his way and he will figure it out. And might it mean a move somewhere else? I mean, it doesn't have to be Fresno, Bakersfield. Like there are other places in the world. But yeah, it might require a move, possibly. You don't know yet. But it's just holding space for you're at the very beginning of the book, and this is what it looks like right now. And yes, there's probably an invitation for you to step into even more fully the alpha role, the breadwinner role, whatever you want to call it, and not expecting him to be that typical alpha male, that typical masculine. So on the deeper layer of soul and spirit and invitation and growth, the question would be, well, this is where we are. So I'm being invited or dragged into stepping into a role, a part of myself that perhaps I haven't fully embraced. Perhaps I have held out for a man to do this for me, or in-laws to give this to me, or my dad, to whatever it is. And it's not that we don't need help in the older generations. It's wonderful when that happens. But there's always an invitation for us to step more fully into our adult selves, and often into that healthy masculine that can accept that role with gratitude instead of with resentment.
Yeah, I think like part of where maybe the resentment is coming from is I feel like, you know, I had people chirping in my ear since I was maybe 22 about how to make everything line up perfectly so that you can have the career, have the marriage, have the family, and that you always need to be cognizant of these things 20 years down the road and like set yourself up for that perfectly. And I worked so hard for years and years and years to like set it up. And I almost feel like resentful, like angry that he didn't have the same, like he didn't have society chirping in his ear about, hey, you need to set this up perfectly, and the focus on family and kids and marriage. Like he got to do all sorts of crazy things. Like he wanted to be an astronaut and went down that path for a little bit and, you know, spent time doing a hobby, like converting a car into an electric car. Like he got to spend all this time just doing what he wanted to do. Whereas like I had to do all this other stuff.
I think that's where the grief is, Tracy. I think you're envious of the path that he has taken that has been more spiral rather than linear, which has included more play and creativity and exploration, and that you fell prey to the dominant mindset of the culture that said you have to plan out your life and you have to do it right and perfectly, be a good girl and a good student and a good worker, and then you will have it all. And so there's a shattering of that promise, that empty promise, because that doesn't exist. There is no hat. If you do it right, the whole world will be yours. That's a big, big grief that's landing in you. And it's being projected onto him because I think you're looking at him and saying, but you did it wrong. You didn't have those people chirping in your ear, and you got to be more and now I'm suffering as a result of you being free. Well, your suffering is not as a result of him being more free. That's where the ego wants to latch on and make it his fault. But he had everything go through life the way he went through life, and it sounds like there was a lot of joy and exploration and creativity along his path, and it wasn't a point A to point B path. And so I think there's a lot of grief for you for the straight road you took, both in where it's landed you and along the way of where you suffered and sacrificed.
Yeah, because it feels like, hey, at least if I did, like, suffer and sacrifice to get here to, like, a good spot, like, I still don't get to win because someone else now didn't do the same, and so it's pulling me down. Like, that's where I get caught again. And so, yeah, I feel like I just keep suffering and sacrificing.
Let me burst that bubble. Even if he had followed the same trajectory and been in a different position, and you guys could buy your perfect house in the perfect neighborhood, you wouldn't be any happier. That's the illusion that you're clinging.
Yeah.
That's where you're getting stuck, is that if he had done it right, I would be lifted out of my suffering. That's the great fantasy of our culture.
Yeah, yeah.
You could be calling me your perfect house in Santa Monica right now, and I guarantee you there would still be suffering. It's not about the house, and it's not about the income. You know, past a certain point, it's not about those things.
I feel like I keep losing sight of that. Like, a couple years ago, I feel like I might have gotten to a better place with that, and then the marriage stuff triggered that whole line of thinking again, where I'm getting caught in the illusion and I can't seem to, like, burst that bubble. Like, it seems so real.
Yes. It seems real because it's a perfect place for pain to attach onto as a way to avoid the pain. There's so many ways into that, that the culture supports, that your lifelong thinking and conditioning supports. And so it's the perfect hook to avoid our pain. Your pain is what needs attention. You're grieving your life path, right? Your transition. You know, you're 39, so you are in your own transition in multiple ways around getting married, around turning 40, around your career. That's yours and yours alone, and that would be there regardless of who you marry.
Yeah.
Every time we have the thought in marriage, and this is true for everybody, and everyone will have this thought in marriage, many times in a marriage, if only I had married someone who, blank, I wouldn't be feeling blank.
Yeah.
A way to avoid whatever that uncomfortable feeling is. Latching onto the great myth of our times, that if you marry the perfect person, you will be lifted out of misery. You'll be lifted out of suffering. Okay?
Yeah.
Have good places to work with, yes?
Yes, but, like, I guess I don't know where to go, you know, so many things to work with, obviously, but I get overwhelmed with, like...
I said to Ruth, when we hang up, I want you to
write
down what stood out for you, make a wheel, put resentment in the middle, and make 6 spokes coming out of there, and write down what is at the end of each spoke that we talked about. All of the different fantasies, expectations, the grieving, your transitions, all of that. so that you have the visual and you can start to work with each individually.
Okay. Thank you so, so much. This is so helpful.
You're so welcome, Tracy. Okay, good. I'm moving right along down the line. I don't see a name. So if you raise your hand. Say hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Is it me?
Yes,
yeah?
It's you. Who is it? Yes.
Hi, my name's Priya. I'm calling from London.
Hi, Priya.
I kind of have quite a lot of affinity with a lot of the women that called. I have this problem where I sometimes feel like just too much emotion, and it sort of, the sadness just tyrannizes over me, that I lose control of my whole body. And it sort of started where my boyfriend decided he'd go on holiday for a month at a time where I wasn't very well and wasn't able to go to work, and I felt like I really needed him. And it's triggered anxiety, like this cycle of anxiety, like separation anxiety, and then depression, where I'd just cry and cry and cry, and I'd cry to him over the phone, and then I think that would trigger something in him where he'd feel I'd get punished. And so we just had this cycle of my anxiety was creating him anxiety, his anxiety was creating my anxiety, and he sort of had doubts about our relationship. So he's sort of paused our plans to get married and start a family, which, as you can imagine, just makes me even more emotional. I tried when he was away, before he went away, I really think, you know, a month is too long to go on holiday. Like maybe 2 weeks would be okay, but I suffer from like separation anxiety because I tried to explain to him, and he just wants to know why and why. And I tried to explain to him, well, you know, it's still counselling in the past, and she thinks that at the stage where my younger brother was born, I was very little, and all of a sudden I wasn't getting as much attention from my mother because my brother was always crying. And I think it probably just sort of triggered, you know, pushed a switch in my brain where I became quite an anxious young child, and then it sort of carried on. But he just keeps, he says he doesn't understand that. He says that, you know, lots of people have younger siblings and they don't have separation anxiety. And he says that he can't move on until he knows why I have separation anxiety, why I've had anxiety and depression. And, you know, I've tried to explain it a couple of times. I think one time I said, oh, you know, I think it was like a year ago that was an anti-anxiety meds, and another time I said it was 2 years ago, so it was obviously getting my dates muddled up. But I think there's just this real, like, I don't know what it is, but he's obviously stuck and he can't move on, and I've got to the stage where I don't know what to do anymore.
Would the two of you, have you considered doing some couples counselling?
So I booked a counsellor and we did 3 sessions, but I didn't find any of them very helpful. With a couples counsellor, yeah.
It was couples.
They didn't really. Yes, it was couples counselling, but I didn't find it that helpful. And what makes things more difficult is that, it's quite expensive, but my boyfriend basically hasn't worked for 6 months, but he's chosen not to work for 6 months for various reasons, to go on his holiday for a month. Now for 2 months, he's sort of chosen to be with his parents while they get their kitchen redone, rather than work, which means that he says that he can't pay for it. And I think part of me is, and my job sort of like in danger with everything going on, so I'm mindful of money as well, but it's more than just the money. I find it really unfair that, like, I have it very fixed in my mind that it should be 50-50,
And I feel like, well, if you can't afford to pay for it now, maybe you can say, you know, maybe Priya, you get the first 5 sessions and I'll get the next 5. And I've sort of said this to him, but he just doesn't see it. Maybe because he's more generous than I am and I'm just being really tight. I don't know, but I just, I haven't, with other therapy, I've sort of I felt better straight away, but with the couples counselling, I haven't really noticed any improvement in 3 sessions, which is unusual compared to, my experience.
As I've mentioned, I think, on other calls in this course, there is only one model of couples counselling that I recommend, and it is the EFT model, emotionally focused therapy. So I don't know if you saw an EFT trained therapist.
Okay.
If it's not EFT, it will either do nothing or make you feel worse.
I think this just made us feel worse.
Yeah.
Because you're basically, you're basically saying to each other. Yeah. Yeah.
You're not at the root. You're just airing all your dirty laundry and then sitting there with it. So the EFT model is so brilliant because it goes underneath the story and the triggers, and it goes into root cause. It goes into the emotions that are being triggered for each of you. So, for example, whatever happened around him going on this trip for a month when you weren't well, of course you would feel abandoned and rejected and anxious and scared. And then whatever was triggered for him as you were expressing that, that's his emotional content to be working with. And that's what would be addressed with a very skilled EFT couples therapist. If you want to email me afterwards, I can give you the name of somebody who you can see over Zoom. And I think it's highly worth giving it a try, doing another 3 sessions, putting the money aside for now and not getting stuck there, and just being generous, taking the higher road and saying, well, this is for the good of our relationship. We need to see if we can work through this and get underneath and get to a different place. And just try 3 sessions or 6 sessions.
Okay. Because my gut feeling is it's just not working out with this. Although he seems very nice, it's just making everything worse. And I know, having spoken to my boyfriend, that he has, he's always trying to still get his parents' validation at the cost of other really important stuff, like paying his mortgage or our relationship. So, and none of that's sort of covered in sessions.
You want to see Priya. He is actually capable of being an adult in the world and in a relationship. You want to see if this is a red flag. Him choosing to away for a month when you're not feeling well and not understanding why that would be hurtful to you is indicative of some narcissism and some adolescent mindset, and the situation with his parents and not wanting to work. You know, to me, and I don't know because I'm just getting the snapshot, it adds up to definitely some big question marks about his capacity or willingness to show up as a real adult in a real relationship. Now, if you already know that, and then the work is about trusting what you already know. If you don't know and you need a third set of eyes, if you need a third person to be in the virtual room with you, then I would encourage the couples counseling.
Okay. And you'd encourage a couples counselor rather than me just having my own counselor?
If you are struggling with self-doubt and you would like another pair of eyes on the relationship, I always want people to be in individual therapy regardless of what's going on. So, to the individual therapy. And that might be plenty for you to clarify and to help you trust yourself and trust what's going on and seeing what's happening through clear eyes.
That might be needed.
Because
he's always saying that, like, what I think is happening isn't happening, and I'm very conscious that as someone who suffers from anxiety, like, that could be true. But so I'd never know. Yeah, I just don't know how, when to trust myself or what to what to feel.
Well, I can tell you just by hearing the snapshot that I would have concerns about the relationship itself and his, like I said, his willingness to grow up.
Yeah.
Whether he's willing to work on that or not, I don't know. Whether he's willing to even own that, I don't know. You know, a red flag is only a red flag if somebody is unwilling to work with it. Because
yeah.
everything can, almost everything anyway, can be worked with.
Yeah,
so,
I just find it really disturbing that he sort of thinks, oh, the reason why it sort of fell apart was because I have separation anxiety. And I did deal with it very badly. I know I did. But at the same time, I think even if I wasn't an anxious person to go away for a month, even if I wasn't ill, it's like, it was a really long time. It's like you're just starting, like about to start your life together.
It is. It
yeah.
definitely is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's
okay.
Definitely cause for concern and for pause and for examining what happened there.
Yeah, and he doesn't have a right, like I feel really bullied in just like having to give an explanation as to why I suffer from separation anxiety, but shouldn't I have like the right to have that boundaries and say, you know, that's personal to me? Because
yes, my guess is that there are deeper layers that were triggered for both of you. And if you wanted to do the couples counseling, you would probably get to those deeper layers pretty quickly. If he's willing.
Okay. Okay. Well, he is willing. Yeah, I think maybe, but that's made me realize maybe we just need to try a different counselor because not everyone works for everyone,
yes.
right? Okay. Okay. Thank
yes.
you so much.
Okay, you're welcome, Priya. Okay, I do see one more hand raised, and I'm sorry I won't be able to get to you. Please speak up early on the next call if you can, although it might be at a time that doesn't work for you, and I apologize for that. Or hop onto the forum. Let me know if you post a question there that you would specifically like me to answer, and I would be happy to do so. Okay. We will close out with a minute of listening to nature's sounds together, and I will look forward to connecting in a few weeks. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here.
The moderator has left the conference.